Side 7. The Gods Themselves, continuing on page 252. Selene said, "Surely I don't arouse your envy and hatred."
"I don't think you do.
What about Neville, though?" Selene was silent. Dennison said, "By the time you got to Neville, you were well known as an intuitionist, I suppose."
"Not well known, I would say. Some physicists suspected it, I'm sure.
However, they don't like to give up credit here any more than on Earth, and I suppose they convinced themselves, more or less, that whatever I had said to them was just a meaningless guess. But Baron knew, of course."
"I see." Dennison paused.
Selene's lips twitched. "Somehow I get the feeling that you want to say, oh, that's why he bothers with you."
"No, of course not, Selene. You're quite attractive enough to be desired for your own sake."
"I think so, too, but every little bit helps, and Baron was bound to be interested in my intuitionism. Why shouldn't he be? Only he insisted I keep my job as a tourist guide. He said I was an important natural resource of the moon, and he didn't want Earth monopolizing me the way they monopolized the synchrotron."
"An odd thought.
But perhaps it was that the fewer who knew of your intuitionism, the fewer would suspect your contribution to what would otherwise be put to his sole credit."
"Now you sound like Baron yourself."
"Do I?
And is it possible he gets rather annoyed with you when your intuitionism is working particularly well?"
Selene shrugged. "Baron is a suspicious man. We all have our faults."
"Is it wise to be alone with me, then?"
Selene said sharply, "Now don't get hurt because I defend him. He doesn't really suspect the possibility of sexual misbehavior between us. You're from Earth. In fact, I might as well tell you he encourages our companionship. He thinks I can learn from you."
"And have you?" asked Dennison coldly.
"I have. Yet, though that may be his chief reason for encouraging our friendship, it isn't mine."
"What's yours?"
"As you well know," said Selene, "and as you want to hear me say, I enjoy your company. Otherwise, I could get what I want in considerably less time."
"All right, Selene. Friends?"
"Friends, absolutely."
"What have you learned from me, then? May I know?"
"That would take a while to explain. You know that the reason we can't set up a pump station anywhere we want to is that we can't locate the para-universe, even though they can locate us. That might be because they are much more intelligent or much more technologically advanced than we are."
"Not necessarily the same thing," muttered Dennison.
"I know. That's why I put in the oar. But it might also be that we are neither particularly stupid nor particularly backward. It might be something as simple as the fact that they offer the harder target. If the strong nuclear interaction is stronger in the para-universe, they'd be bound to have much smaller suns and, very likely, much smaller planets. Their individual world would be harder to locate than ours would be." "Or then again," she went on, "suppose it's the electromagnetic field they detect. The electromagnetic field of a planet is much larger than the planet itself, and is much easier to locate. And that would mean that while they can detect Earth, they can't detect the Moon, which has no electromagnetic field to speak of. That's why, perhaps, we failed to set up a pump station on the Moon. And if their small planets lack a significant electromagnetic field, we can't locate them."
Dennison said, "It's an attractive thought."
"Next, consider the inter-universal exchange in properties that serve to weaken their strong nuclear interaction, cooling their suns, while strengthening ours, heating and exploding our suns. What might that imply? Suppose they can collect energy one way without our help, but only at ruinously low efficiencies. Under ordinary circumstances, that would therefore be utterly impractical. They would need us to help direct concentrated energy in their direction by supplying tungsten-186 to them and accepting plutonium-186 in return. But suppose our galactic arm implodes into a quasar. That would produce an energy concentration in the neighborhood of the solar system enormously greater than now exists, and one that might persist for over 1,000,000 years. Once that quasar forms, even a ruinously low efficiency becomes sufficient.
It wouldn't matter to them, therefore, whether we are destroyed or not. In fact, we might argue that it would be safer for them if we did explode. Until we do, we might end the pump for any of a variety of reasons, and they would be helpless to start it again. After the explosion, they are home free. No one could interfere. And that's why those people who say, if the pump is so dangerous, why don't those terribly clever paramen stop it, don't know what they're talking about.
Did Neville give you that argument?
Yes, he did.
But the parasun would keep cooling down, wouldn't it?
What does that matter? Said Selene impatiently. With the pump, they wouldn't be dependent on their sun for anything.
Dennison took a deep breath. You can't possibly know this, Selene, but there was a rumor on Earth that Lamont received a message from the paramen to the effect that the pump was dangerous, but that they couldn't stop it. No one took it seriously, of course, but suppose it's true. Suppose Lamont did receive such a message. Might it be that some of the paramen were humanitarian enough to wish not to destroy a world with cooperating intelligences upon it, and were prevented by the opposition of an oh-so-practical majority?
Selene nodded. I suppose that's possible. All this I knew, or rather intuited, before you came on the scene. But then you said that nothing between one and the infinite made any sense, remember?
Of course.
All right. The differences between our universe and the para-universe lie so obviously in the strong nuclear interaction that so far it's all that's been studied. But there is more than one interaction. There are four. In addition to the strong nuclear, there is the electromagnetic, the weak nuclear, and the gravitational, with intensity ratios of 130:1 to 10^-10 to 10^-42. But if four, why not an infinite number, with all the others too weak to be detectable or to influence our universe in any way?
Dennison said, if an interaction is too weak to be detectable or to exert influence in any way, then by any operational definition it doesn't exist.
In this universe, said Selene with a snap, who knows what does or does not exist in the para-universes? With an infinite number of possible interactions, each of which can vary infinitely in intensity compared to any one of them taken as standard, the number of different possible universes that can exist is infinite.
Possibly the infinity of the continuum, Aleph 1 rather than Aleph Null.
Selene frowned. What does that mean?
It's not important. Go on.
Selene said, instead, then, of trying to work with the one para-universe that has impinged itself on us and which may not suit our needs at all, why don't we instead try to work out which universe, out of all the infinite possibilities, best suits us and is most easily located? Let us design a universe, for after all, whatever we design must exist, and search for it.
Dennison smiled. Selene, I've thought of exactly the same thing. And while there's no law that states I can't be completely wrong, it's very unlikely that anyone as brilliant as myself can be completely wrong when anyone as brilliant as yourself comes to exactly the same conclusion independently.
You know what?
What? Asked Selene.
I'm beginning to like your damn moon food, or getting used to it anyway. Let's go back home and eat, and then we can start working out our plans. And you know what else?
What?
As long as we'll be working together, how about one kiss, as experimentalist to intuitionist?
Selene considered. She said, we've both of us kissed and been kissed a good many times, I suppose. How about doing it as man to woman?
I think I can manage that. But what do I do so as not to be clumsy about it? What are the moon rules for kissing?
Follow instinct, said Selene casually. Carefully, Dennison placed his arms behind his back and leaned towards Selene. Then, after a while, he placed his arms behind her back.
13. And then I actually kissed him back, said Selene thoughtfully.
Oh, did you? Said Baron Neville harshly. Well, that's valor beyond the call of duty.
I don't know. It wasn't that bad. In fact, and she smiled, he was rather touching about it. He was afraid he would be clumsy, and began by putting his arms behind his back so that he wouldn't crush me, I suppose.
Spare me the details.
Why, what the hell do you care? She fired up suddenly. You're Mr. Platonic, aren't you?
You want it differently, now?
We needn't perform to order.
But you had better. When do you expect to give us what we need?
As soon as I can, she said tonelessly.
Without his knowing?
He's interested only in energy.
And in saving the world, mocked Neville, and in being a hero, and in showing everybody, and in kissing you.
He admits to all that. What do you admit to?
Impatience, said Neville angrily. Lots of impatience.
14.
I am glad, said Denison deliberately, that the daytime is over.
He held out his right arm and stared at it, encased in its protective layers.
The lunar sun is one thing I can't get used to and don't want to get used to. Even this suit seems a natural thing to me in comparison.
What's wrong with the sun? Asked Selenie.
Don't tell me you like it, Selenie.
No, of course not. I hate it. But then I never see it. You're used to the sun.
Not the way it is here on the moon. It shines out of a black sky here. It dazzles the stars away instead of muffling them. It is hot, hard, and dangerous. It is an enemy. And while it's in the sky, I can't help but feel that none of our attempts at reducing field intensity will succeed.
That's superstition, then, said Selenie, with a distant edge of exasperation. The sun has nothing to do with it. We were in the crater shadow anyhow, and it was just like night, stars and all.
Not quite, said Denison. Any time we looked northward, Selenie, we could see that stretch of sunlight glittering. I hated to look northward, yet the direction dragged at my eyes. Every time I looked at it, I could feel the hard ultraviolet springing at my viewplate.
That's imagination. In the first place, there's no ultraviolet to speak of in reflected light, and in the second, your suit protects you against radiation.
Not against heat, not very much.
But it's night now.
Yes, said Denison with satisfaction, and this I like.
He looked about with a continuing wonder. Earth was in the sky, of course, in its accustomed place, a fat crescent now, bellying to the southwestward. The constellation Orion was above it, a hunter rising up out of the brilliant curved chair of Earth. The horizon glittered in the dim crescent Earth light.
It's beautiful, he said.
Then, Selenie, is the pionizer showing anything? Selenie, who was looking at the skies with no comment, stepped toward the maze of equipment that, over the past three alternations of day and night, had been assembled there in the shadow of the crater.
Not yet, she said, but that's good news, really. The field intensity is holding at just over 50.
Not low enough, said Denison.
Selenie said, it can be lowered further. I'm sure that all the parameters are suitable.
The magnetic field, too?
I'm not sure about the magnetic field.
If we strengthen that, the whole thing becomes unstable.
It shouldn't. I know it shouldn't.
Selenie, I trust your intuition against everything but the facts. It does get unstable. We've tried it.
I know, Ben, but not quite with this geometry. It's been holding at 52 a phenomenally long time. Surely, if we begin to hold it there for hours instead of minutes, we ought to be able to strengthen the magnetic field tenfold for a period of minutes instead of seconds. Let's try.
Not yet, said Denison.
Selenie hesitated, then stepped back, turning away. She said, You still don't miss Earth, do you, Ben?
No. It's rather odd, but I don't. I would have thought it inevitable that I missed blue sky, green earth, flowing water, all the cliché adjective-noun combinations peculiar to Earth. I miss none of them. I don't even dream about them.
Selenie said, This sort of thing does happen sometimes. At least,
There are innies who say they experience no homesickness. They're in the minority, of course, and no one has ever been able to decide what this minority has in common. Guesses run all the way from serious emotional deficiency, no capacity to feel anything, to serious emotional excess, a fear to admit homesickness, lest it lead to breakdown. In my case, I think it's plain enough. Life on Earth was not very enjoyable for 2 decades and more, while here I work at last in a field I have made my own, and I have your help. More than that, Selene, I have your company. You are kind, said Selene gravely, to place company and help in the relationship you do. You don't seem to need much help. Do you pretend to seek it for the sake of my company?
Denison laughed softly. I'm not sure which answer would flatter you more.
Try the truth. The truth is not so easy to determine when I value each so much. He turned back to the pionizer.
The field intensity still holds, Selene.
Selene's faceplate glinted in the earthlight. She said, Baron says that non-homesickness is natural and the sign of a healthy mind. He says that though the human body was adapted to Earth's surface and requires adjustment to the moon, the human brain was not and does not. The human brain is so different, qualitatively, from all other brains that it can be considered a new phenomenon. It has had no time to be really fixed to Earth's surface and can, without adjustment, fit other environments. He says that enclosure in the caverns of the moon may actually suit it best of all, for that is but a larger version of its enclosure in the cavern of the skull.
You believe that? Asked Denison, amused.
When Baron talks, he can make things sound very plausible.
I think it can be made equally plausible to claim that the comfort to be found in the caverns of the moon is the result of the fulfillment of the return to the womb fantasy. In fact, he added thoughtfully, considering the controlled temperature and pressure, the nature and digestibility of the food, I could make a good case for considering the lunar colony, I beg your pardon, Selene, the lunar city, a deliberate reconstruction of the fetal environment.
Selene said, I don't think Baron would agree with you for a minute.
I'm sure he wouldn't, said Denison.
He looked at the Earth crescent, watching the distant cloud banks on edge. He fell into silence, absorbed in the view, and even though Selene moved back to the pionizer, he remained in place. He watched Earth in its nest of stars and looked toward the serrated horizon where, every once in a while, it seemed to him he saw a puff of smoke where a small meteorite might be landing. He had pointed out a similar phenomenon with some concern to Selene during the previous lunar night. She had been unconcerned. She said, The Earth does shift slightly in the sky because of the moon's libration, and every once in a while a shaft of earthlight tops a small rise and falls on a bit of soil beyond. It comes into view like a tiny puff of rising dust. It's common. We pay no attention.
Denison had said, But it could be a meteorite sometimes. Don't meteorites ever strike?
Of course they do. You're probably hit by several every time you're out. Your suit protects you.
I don't mean microdust particles. I mean sizable meteorites that would really kick up the dust. Meteorites that could kill you.
Well, they fall too, but they are few and the moon is large. No one has been hit yet. And as Denison watched the sky and thought of that, he saw what, in the midst of his momentary preoccupation, he took to be a meteorite. Light streaking through the sky could, however, be a meteorite only on Earth with its atmosphere, and not on the airless moon. The light in the sky was man-made, and Denison had not yet sorted out his impressions when it became, quite clearly, a small rocket vessel sinking rapidly to a landing beside him. A single-suited figure emerged, while a pilot remained within, barely seen as a dark splotch among the highlights. Denison waited. The etiquette of the spacesuit required the newcomer joining any group to announce himself first.
Commissioner Gottstein here, the new voice said, as you can probably tell from my wobble.
Van Denison here, said Denison. Yes, I thought as much.
Did you come here looking for me?
Certainly.
In a space skipper, you might...
I might, said Gottstein, have used outlet P4, which is less than 1,000 yards from here.
Yes, indeed.
But I wasn't looking only for you.
Well, I won't ask for the meaning of what you say.
There's no reason for me to be coy. Surely you had not expected me to be uninterested in the fact that you have been carrying on experiments on the lunar surface.
It's been no secret, and anyone might be interested.
Yet no one seems to know the details of the experiments, except, of course, that in some way you are working on matters concerning the electron pump.
It's a reasonable assumption.
Is it? It seemed to me that experiments of such a nature, to have any value at all, would require a rather enormous setup. This is not of my own knowledge, you understand. I consulted those who would know. And, it is quite obvious, you are not working on such a setup. It occurred to me, therefore, that you might not be the proper focus of my interest. While my attention was drawn to you, others might be undertaking more important tasks.
Why should I be used as distraction?
I don't know. If I knew, I would be less concerned.
So, I have been under observation.
Gottstein chuckled.
That, yes, since you have arrived.
But while you have been working here on the surface, we have observed this entire region for miles in every direction. Oddly enough, it would seem that you, Dr. Dennison, and your companion, are the only ones on the lunar surface for any but the most routine of purposes.
Why is that odd?
Because it means that you really think you're doing something with your gimcrack contraption, whatever it is. I can't believe that you are incompetent, so I think it would be worth listening to you if you tell me what you are doing.
I am experimenting in paraphysics, Commissioner,
precisely as rumor has it, to which I can add that so far my experiments have been only partly successful.
Your companion is, I imagine, Selene Lindstrom L., a tourist guide.
Yes.
An unusual choice as an assistant.
She is intelligent, eager, interested, and extremely attractive.
And willing to work with an Earthman.
And quite willing to work with an immigrant who will be a lunar citizen as soon as he qualifies for that status.
Selene was approaching now. Her voice rang in their ears.
Good day, Commissioner. I would have liked not to overhear and intrude on a private conversation, but in a spacesuit, overhearing is inevitable anywhere within the horizon.
Gottstein turned. Hello, Miss Lindstrom. I did not expect to talk in secrecy. Are you interested in paraphysics?
Oh, yes.
You are not disheartened by the failures of the experiments.
They are not entirely failures, she said. They are less a failure than Dr. Dennison thinks at present.
What?
Dennison turned sharply on his heel, nearly overbalancing himself and sending out a spurt of dust. All three were facing the pionizer now, and above it, just about 5 feet above it, light shone like a fat star.
Selene said, I raised the intensity of the magnetic field, and the nuclear field remained stable, in being, then eased further and further, and
leaked, Dennison said. Damn it! I didn't see it happen.
Selene said, I'm sorry, Ben. First you were lost in your own thoughts, then the commissioner arrived, and I couldn't resist the chance of crying on my own.
Gottstein said, but just what is it that I see there?
Dennison said, energy being spontaneously given off by matter leaking from another universe into ours.
And even as he said that, the light blinked out, and many yards away, a farther, dimmer star came into simultaneous being.
Dennison lunged toward the pionizer, but Selene, all lunar grace, propelled herself across the surface more efficiently and was there first. She killed the field structure, and the distant star went out.
She said, the leak point isn't stable, you see.
Not on a small scale, said Dennison. But considering that a shift of a light year is as theoretically possible as a shift of 100 yards, one of 100 yards only is miraculous stability. "Not miraculous enough," said Stalin flatly. Gottstein interrupted.
"Let me guess what you're talking about. You mean that the matter can leak through here or there or anywhere in our universe at random?"
"Not quite at random, Commissioner," said Dennison. "The probability of leakage drops with distance from the pionizer, and rather sharply, I should say. The sharpness depends on a variety of factors, and I think we've tightened the situation remarkably. Even so, a flip of a few hundred yards is quite probable, and, as a matter of fact, you saw it happen."
"And it might have shifted to somewhere within the city, or within our own helmets, perhaps."
Dennison said impatiently, "No, no. The leak, at least by the techniques we use, is heavily dependent on the density of matter already present in this universe. The chances are virtually nil that the leak position would shift from a place of essential vacuum to one where an atmosphere even a hundredth as dense as that within the city or within our helmets would exist. It would be impractical to expect to arrange the leak anywhere but into a vacuum in the first place, which is why we had to make the attempt up here on the surface."
"Then this is not like the electron pump."
"Not at all," said Dennison. "In the electron pump, there is a two-way transfer of matter, here a one-way leak. Nor are the universes involved the same."
Gottstein said, "I wonder if you would have dinner with me this evening, Dr. Dennison."
Dennison hesitated. "Myself only?" Gottstein attempted a bow in the direction of Selene, but could accomplish only a grotesque parody of it in its space suit. "I would be charmed to have Miss Lindstrom's company on another occasion, but on this one I must speak with you alone, Dr. Dennison."
"Oh, go ahead," said Selene crisply, as Dennison still hesitated. "I have a heavy schedule tomorrow anyway, and you'll need time to worry about the leak point instability."
Dennison said uncertainly, "Well then, Selene, will you let me know when your next free day is?"
"I always do, don't I? And we'll be in touch before then anyway. Why don't you two go on? I'll take care of the equipment."
15. Baron Neville shifted from foot to foot in the fashion made necessary by the restricted quarters and by the moon's gravity. In a larger room, under a world's stronger pull, he would have walked hastily up and back. Here, he tilted from side to side in a repetitive back-and-forth glide.
"Then you're positive it works, right, Selene? You're positive?"
"I'm positive," said Selene. "I've told you 5 times by actual count." Neville didn't seem to be listening. He said in a low, rapid voice, "It doesn't matter that Gottstein was there then. He didn't try to stop the experiment."
"No, of course not.
There was no indication that he would try to exert authority."
"Now, Baron, what kind of authority could he exert? Will Earth send a police force? Besides, oh, you know they can't stop us."
Neville stopped moving, stood motionless for a while.
"They don't know? They still don't know?"
"Of course they don't. Ben was looking at the stars, and then Gottstein came. So I tried for the field leak, got it, and I had already gotten the other. Ben's setup..."
"Don't call it his setup. It was your idea, wasn't it?"
Selene shook her head. "I made vague suggestions. The details were Ben's."
"But you can reproduce it now. For Luna's sake, we don't have to go to the Earthy for it, do we?"
"I think I can reproduce enough of it now so that our people can fill it in."
"All right, then. Let's get started."
"Not yet. Oh, damn it, Baron, not yet."
"Why not yet?"
"We need the energy, too."
"But we have that."
"Not quite. The leak point is unstable, pretty badly unstable."
"But that can be fixed up. You said so."
"I said I thought it could."
"That's good enough for me."
"Just the same, it would be better to have Ben work out the details and stabilize it." There was a silence between them. Neville's thin face slowly twisted into something approaching hostility.
"You don't think I can do it, is that it?"
Selene said, "Will you come out on the surface with me and work on it?" There was another silence. Neville said unsteadily, "I don't appreciate your sarcasm, and I don't want to have to wait long.
I can't command the laws of nature, but I think it won't be long. Now, if you don't mind, I need my sleep. I've got my tourists tomorrow. For a moment, Neville seemed on the point of gesturing to his own bed alcove as though offering hospitality, but the gesture, if that was what it was, did not really come to birth, and Selene made no sign of understanding or even anticipating. She nodded wearily and left. 16. I had hoped, to be frank, said Gottstein, smiling over what passed for dessert, a sticky, sweet concoction, that we would have seen each other more often. Dennison said, it is kind of you to take such an interest in my work. If the leak instability can be corrected, I think my achievement, and that of Miss Lindstrom, will have been a most significant one. You speak carefully, like a scientist. I won't insult you by offering the lunar equivalent of a liqueur. That is the one approximation to Earth's cuisine I have simply made up my mind not to tolerate. Can you tell me, in lay language, what makes the achievement significant? I can try, said Dennison cautiously. Suppose we start with the para-universe. It has a more intense, strong nuclear interaction than our universe has, so that relatively small masses of protons in the para-universe can undergo the fusion reaction capable of supporting its star. Masses equivalent to our stars would explode violently in the para-universe, which has many more, but much smaller stars than ours does. Suppose now that we had a much less intense strong nuclear interaction than that which prevails in our universe. In that case, huge masses of protons would have so little tendency to fuse that a very large mass of hydrogen would be needed to support a star. Such an anti-para-universe, one that was the opposite of the para-universe, in other words, would consist of considerably fewer but of far larger stars than our universe does. In fact, if the strong nuclear interaction were made sufficiently weak, a universe would exist which consisted of a single star containing all the mass in that universe. It would be a very dense star, but relatively non-reactive, and giving off no more radiation than our single sun does, perhaps. Gottstein said, am I wrong, or isn't that the situation that prevailed in our own universe before the time of the Big Bang, one vast body containing all the universal mass? Yes, said Dennison. As a matter of fact, the antipara universe I am picturing consists of what some call a cosmic egg, or cosmeg for short. A cosmeg universe is what we need if we are to probe for one-way leakage. The para universe we are now using, with its tiny stars, is virtually empty space. You can probe and touch nothing. The paramen reached us, however. Yes, possibly by following magnetic fields. There is some reason to think that there are no planetary magnetic fields of significance in the para-universe, which deprives us of the advantage they have. On the other hand, if we probe the cosmeg universe, we cannot fail. The cosmeg is itself the entire universe, and wherever we probe, we strike matter. But how do you probe for it? Dennison hesitated. That is the part I find difficult to explain. Pions are the mediating particles of the strong nuclear interaction. The intensity of the interaction depends on the mass of the pions, and that mass can, under certain specialized conditions, be altered. The lunar physicists have developed an instrument they call the pionizer, which can be made to do just such a thing. Once the pion's mass is decreased, or increased for that matter, it is, effectively, part of another universe. It becomes a gateway, a crossing point. If it is decreased sufficiently, it can be made part of a cosmic universe, and that's what we want. Gottstein said, and you can suck in matter from the cosmic universe? That part is easy. Once the gateway forms, the influx is spontaneous. The matter enters with its own laws and is stable when it arrives. Gradually, the laws of our own universe soak in, the strong interaction grows stronger, and the matter fuses and begins to give off enormous energy. But if it is super-dense,
Why doesn't it just expand in a puff of smoke?
That, too, would yield energy. But that depends on the electromagnetic field. And in this particular case, the strong interaction takes precedence, because we control the electromagnetic field. It would take quite a time to explain that.
Well then, the globe of light that I saw on the surface was cosmic material fusing?
Yes, Commissioner.
And that energy can be harnessed for useful purposes?
Certainly.
And in any quantity. What you saw was the arrival in our universe of micro-microgram masses of cosmeg. There's nothing, in theory, to prevent our bringing it over in ton lots.
Well then, this can be used to replace the electron pump.
Dennison shook his head.
No.
The use of cosmic energy also alters the properties of the universes in question. The strong interaction gradually grows more intense in the cosmic universe and less intense in ours as the laws of nature cross over. That means that the cosmic slowly undergoes fusion at a greater rate and gradually warms up. Eventually, said Gottstein, crossing his arms across his chest and narrowing his eyes thoughtfully, it explodes in a big bang.
That's my feeling.
Do you suppose that's what happened to our own universe 10 billion years ago?
Perhaps.
Cosmogonists had wondered why the original cosmic egg exploded at some one point in time and not at another. One solution was to imagine an oscillating universe in which the cosmic egg was formed and then at once exploded. The oscillating universe has been eliminated as a possibility, and the conclusion is that the cosmic egg had to exist for some long period of time, and then went through a crisis of instability, which arose for some unknown reason, but which may have been the result of the tapping of its energy across the universes.
Possibly, but not necessarily by some intelligence. Perhaps there are occasional spontaneous leaks.
And when the Big Bang takes place, said Gottstein, can we still extract energy from the cosmic universe?
I'm not sure, but surely that is not an immediate worry.
The leakage of our strong interaction field into the cosmic universe must very likely continue for millions of years before pushing it past the critical point. And there must be other cosmic universes, an infinite number, perhaps.
What about the change in our own universe?
The strong interaction weakens. Slowly, very slowly, our sun cools off. Can we use cosmic energy to make up for that?
That would not be necessary, Commissioner, said Dennison earnestly.
While the strong interaction here in our universe weakens as a result of the cosmic pump, it strengthens through the action of the ordinary electron pump. If we adjust the energy productions of the two, then, though the laws of nature change in the cosmic universe and in the para-universe, they do not change in ours. We are a highway, but not the terminus in either direction. Nor need we be disturbed on behalf of the terminuses. The paramen, on their side, may have adjusted themselves to the cooling off of their sun, which may be pretty cool to begin with. As for the cosmic universe, there is no reason to suspect life can exist there. Indeed, it is by inducing the conditions required for the Big Bang that we may be setting up a new kind of universe that will eventually grow hospitable to life. For a while, Gottstein said nothing. His plump face in repose seemed emotionless. He nodded to himself as though following the line of his own thoughts. Finally, he said, "You know, Dennison, I think this is what will set the world on its ear. Any difficulty in persuading the scientific leadership that the electron pump is destroying the world should now disappear." Dennison said, "The emotional reluctance to accept that no longer exists. It will be possible to present the problem and the solution at the same time."
"When would you be willing to prepare a paper to this effect, if I guarantee speedy publication?"
"Can you guarantee that?"
"In a government-published pamphlet, if no other way."
"I would prefer to try to neutralize the leak instability before reporting."
"Of course.
"And I think it would be wise," said Dennison, "to arrange to have Dr. Peter Lamont as co-author. He can make the mathematics rigorous, something I cannot do. Besides, it was through his work that I took the course I have followed."
"One more point, Commissioner."
"Yes?" "I would suggest that the lunar physicists be involved. One of their number, Dr. Baron Neville, might well be a third author."
"But why? Aren't you introducing unnecessary complications now?"
"It was their pionizer that made everything possible."
"There can be appropriate mention of that. But did Dr. Baron actually work on the project with you?"
"Not directly."
"Then why involve him?"
Dennison looked down and brushed his hand thoughtfully over the weave of his pants leg. He said, "It would be the diplomatic thing to do. We would need to set up the Cosmeg pump on the moon."
"Why not on Earth?"
"In the first place, we need a vacuum. This is a one-way transfer and not a two-way, as in the case of the electron pump, and the conditions necessary to make it practical are different in the two cases. The surface of the moon has its vacuum ready-made in vast quantities, while to prepare one on Earth would involve an enormous effort."
"Yet it could be done, couldn't it?"
"Secondly," said Dennison, "if we have two vast energy sources from opposite directions with our own universe between, there would be something like a short circuit if the two outlets were too close together. Separation by 250,000 miles of vacuum, with the electron pump operating only on Earth and the Cosmeg pump operating only on the moon, would be ideal, in fact, necessary. And if we are to operate on the moon, it would be wise, even decent, to take the sensibilities of the lunar physicists into account. We ought to give them a share."
Gottstein smiled. "Is this the advice of Miss Lindstrom?"
"I'm sure it would be, but the suggestion is reasonable enough to have occurred to me independently."
Gottstein rose, stretched, and then jumped in place two or three times in the eerily slow fashion imposed by lunar gravity. He flexed his knees each time. He sat down again and said, "Ever try that, Dr. Dennison?"
Dennison shook his head.
"It's supposed to help the circulation in the lower extremities. I do it whenever I feel my legs may be going to sleep. I'll be heading back for a short visit to Earth before long, and I'm trying to keep from getting too used to lunar gravity. Shall we talk of Miss Lindstrom, Dr. Dennison?"
Dennison said in a quite changed tone, "What about her?"
"She is a tourist guide."
"Yes, you said so earlier."
"As I also said, she is an odd assistant for a physicist."
"Actually, I'm an amateur physicist only, and I suppose she is an amateur assistant."
Gottstein was no longer smiling. "Don't play games, Doctor. I have taken the trouble to find out what I can about her. Her record is quite revealing, or would have been if it had occurred to anyone to look at it before this. I believe she is an intuitionist."
Dennison said, "Many of us are. I have no doubt you are an intuitionist yourself, after a fashion. I certainly know that I am, after a fashion."
"There is a difference, Doctor. You are an accomplished scientist, and I hope, am an accomplished administrator. Yet, while Miss Lindstrom is enough of an intuitionist to be useful to you in advanced theoretical physics, she is, in actual fact, a tourist guide."
Dennison hesitated.
"She has little formal training, Commissioner. Her intuitionism is at an unusually high level, but it is under little conscious control." "Is she the result of the one-time genetic engineering program?"
"I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if that were so, however."
"Do you trust her?"
"In what way? She has helped me."
"Do you know that she is the wife of Dr. Baron Neville?"
"There is an emotional connection, not a legal one, I believe."
"None of the connections are what we would call legal here on the moon. The same Neville you want to invite as third author of the paper you are to write?"
"Yes."
"Is that merely a coincidence?"
"No.
Neville was interested in my arrival, and I believe he asked Selene to help me in my work.
Did she tell you this?
She said he was interested in me. That was natural enough, I suppose.
Does it occur to you, Dr. Dennison, that she may be working in her own interests and in those of Dr. Nether?
In what way would their interests differ from ours? She has helped me without reservation.
Gottstein shifted position and moved his shoulders as though he were going through muscle-pulling exercises. He said,
Dr. Neville must know that a woman so close to himself is an intuitionist. Wouldn't he use her? Why would she remain a tourist guide, if not to mask her abilities or a purpose?
I understand Dr. Neville frequently reasons in this fashion. I find it difficult to suspect unnecessary conspiracies.
How do you know they are unnecessary? When my space skipper was hovering over the moon's surface just before the ball of radiation formed over your equipment, I was looking down at you. You were not at the thionizer.
Dennison thought back.
No, I wasn't. I was looking at the stars. Rather a tendency of mine on the surface.
What was Miss Lindstrom doing?
I didn't see. She said she strengthened the magnetic field, and the leak finally broke through.
Is it customary for her to manipulate the equipment without you?
No, but I can understand the impulse.
And would there have been some sort of an ejection?
I don't understand you.
I'm not sure I understand myself. There was a dim sparkle in the earthlight, as though something was flying through the air. I don't know what.
I don't either, said Dennison.
You can't think of anything that might naturally have to do with the equipment that...
No.
Then what was Miss Lindstrom doing?
I still don't know.
For a moment, the silence was heavy between them. Then the commissioner said, As I see it, then, you will try to correct the leak instability and will be thinking about the preparation of a paper. I will get matters into motion at the other end, and on my shortly forthcoming visit to Earth will make arrangements to have the paper published and will alert the government.
It was a clear dismissal. Dennison rose, and the commissioner said eagerly,
And think about Dr. Neville and Miss Lindstrom.
17. It was a heavier star of radiation, a fatter one, a brighter one. Dennison could feel its warmth on his faceplate and backed away. There was a distinct X-ray component in the radiation, and though this shielding should take care of that, there was no point in placing it under a strain.
I guess we can't question it, he muttered. The leak point is stable.
I'm sure of it, said Selene flatly.
Then let's turn it off and go back to the city.
They moved slowly, and Dennison felt oddly dispirited. There was no uncertainty anymore, no excitement. From this point on, there was no chance of failure. The government was interested. More and more, it would be out of his own hands. He said, I suppose I can begin the paper now.
I suppose so, said Selene carefully.
Have you talked to Baron again?
Yes, I have.
Any difference in his attitude?
None at all. He will not participate.
Then?
Yes?
I really don't think it's any use talking to him. He will not cooperate in any project with the Earth government.
But you've explained the situation?
Completely.
And he still won't?
He's asked to see Gottstein, and the commissioner agreed to an interview after he returns from his Earth visit.
We'll have to wait till then.
Maybe Gottstein can have some effect on him, but I doubt it.
Dennison shrugged, a useless maneuver inside his spacesuit.
I don't understand him.
I do, said Selene softly.
Dennison did not respond directly. He shoved the pionizer and its attendant apparatus into its rocky shelter and said, Ready?
Ready.
They slipped into the surface entrance at outlet P4 in silence, and Dennison climbed down the entry ladder. Selene dropped past him, breaking in quick holds at individual rungs. Dennison had learned to do that, but he was dispirited,
and climbed down in a kind of rebellious refusal to accept acclamation. They removed their suits in the staging areas, placed them in their lockers. Denison said, "Would you join me for lunch, Selene?" Selene said uneasily, "You seem upset. Is something wrong?"
"Reaction, I think."
"Lunch?"
"Yes, of course."
They ate in Selene's quarters. She insisted, saying, "I want to talk to you, and I can't do it properly in the cafeteria." And when Denison was chewing slowly at something that had a faint resemblance to peanut-flavored veal, she said, "Ben, you haven't said a word, and you've been like this for a week."
"No, I haven't," said Denison, frowning.
"Yes, you have." She looked into his eyes with concern. "I'm not sure how good my intuition is outside physics, but I suppose there's something you don't want to tell me."
Denison shrugged. "They're making a fuss about all this back on Earth. Gottstein has been pulling its strings as tough as cables in advance of his trip back. Dr. Lamont is being lionized, and they want me to come back once the paper is written."
"Back to Earth?"
"Yes. It seems I'm a hero, too."
"You should be."
"Complete rehabilitation," said Denison thoughtfully, "is what they offer. It's clear I can get a position in any suitable university or government agency on Earth."
"Isn't that what you wanted?"
"It's what I imagine Lamont wants and would enjoy and will certainly get. But I don't want it."
Selene said, "What do you want, then?"
"I want to stay on the moon."
"Why?"
"Because it's the cutting edge of humanity, and I want to be part of that cutting edge. I want to work at the establishment of cosmic pumps, and that will be only here on the moon. I want to work on paratheory with the kind of instruments you can dream up and handle, Selene. I want to be with you, Selene. But will you stay with me?"
"I am as interested in paratheory as you are."
Denison said, "But won't Neville pull you off the job now?"
"Baron pull me off?" she said tightly. "Are you trying to insult me, Ben?"
"Not at all."
"Well, then, do I misunderstand you? Are you suggesting that I'm working with you because Baron ordered me to?"
"Didn't he?"
"Yes, he did. But that's not why I'm here. I choose to be here. He may think he can order me about, but he can only do so when his orders coincide with my will, as in your case they did. I resent his thinking he can order me otherwise, and I resent your thinking it too.
You two are sex partners."
"We have been, yes. But what has that to do with it? By that argument, I can order him about it easily as he me."
"Then you can work with me, Selene?"
"Certainly," she said coldly, "if I choose to."
"But do you choose to?"
"As of now, yes."
And Denison smiled. "The chance that you might not choose to, or even might not be able to, is, I think, what has really been worrying me this past week. I dreaded the end of the project if it meant the end of you. I'm sorry, Selene. I don't mean to plague you with a sentimental attachment of an old earthy."
"Well, there's nothing old earthy about your mind, Ben. There are other attachments than sexual. I like being with you."
There was a pause, and Denison's smile faded, then returned, perhaps a thought more mechanically. "I'm glad for my mind."
Denison looked away, shook his head slightly, then turned back. She watched him carefully, almost anxiously.
Denison said, "Selene, there's more than energy involved in the cross-universe leaks. I suspect you've been thinking about that." The silence stretched out now, painfully, and finally Selene said,
"Oh, that."
For a while the two stared at each other, Denison embarrassed, Selene almost furtive.
18.
Gottstein said, "I haven't quite got my moon legs yet, but this isn't anything compared to what it cost me to get my earth legs. Denison, you had better not dream of returning. You'll never make it."
"I have no intention of returning, Commissioner," said Denison. In a way, it's too bad. You could be emperor by acclamation. As for Hallam,
Denison said wistfully, I would have liked to see his face, but that's a small ambition.
Lamont, of course, is receiving the lion's share. He's on the spot.
I don't mind that. He deserves a good deal.
Do you think Neville will really join us?
No question. He's on his way at this moment. Listen.
Gottstein's voice dropped one conspiratorial note in pitch.
Before he comes, would you like a bar of chocolate?
What?
A bar of chocolate with almonds.
One.
I have some.
Denison's face, from initial confusion, suddenly lit with comprehension.
Real chocolate?
Yes.
Certain.
His face hardened. No, Commissioner.
No?
No. If I taste real chocolate, then, for the few minutes it's in my mouth, I'm going to miss Earth. I'm going to miss everything about it. I can't afford that. I don't want it. Don't even show it to me. Don't let me smell it or see it.
The Commissioner looked discomfited.
You're right. He made an obvious attempt to change the subject. The excitement on Earth is overwhelming. Of course, we made a considerable effort to save Hallam's face. He'll continue to hold some position of importance, but he'll have little real say.
He's getting more consideration than he gave others, said Denison resignedly.
It's not for his sake. You can't smash a personal image that has been built to such a level of importance. It would reflect on science itself. The good name of science is more important than Hallam, either way.
I disapprove of that in principle, said Denison warmly. Science must take what blows it deserves.
A time and a place for it. There's Dr. Neville.
Gottstein composed his face. Denison shifted his chair to face the entrance.
Baron Neville entered solemnly. Somehow, there was less than ever of the lunar delicacy about his figure. He greeted the two curtly, sat down, and crossed his legs. He was clearly waiting for Gottstein to speak first.
The Commissioner said, I am glad to see you, Dr. Neville. Dr. Denison tells me that you refused to append your name to what I am sure will be a classic paper on the cosmic pump.
No need to do so, said Neville. What happens on Earth is of no interest to me.
You are aware of the cosmic pump experiments? Of its implications?
All of them. I know the situation as well as you two do.
Then I will proceed without preliminaries. I have returned from Earth, Dr. Neville, and it is quite settled as to what will be the course of future procedure. Large cosmic pump stations will be set up on three different places on the lunar surface in such a way that one will always be in the night shadow. Half the time, two will be. Those in the night shadow will be constantly generating energy, most of which will simply radiate into space. The purpose will be not so much to use the energy for practical purposes as to counteract the changes in field intensities induced by the electron pump.
Denison interrupted. For some years, we will have to overbalance the electron pump to restore our section of the universe to the point at which it was before the pump began operation.
Neville nodded.
Will Luna City have the use of any of it?
If necessary. We feel the solar batteries will probably supply what you need, but there is no objection to supplementation.
That is kind of you, said Neville, not bothering to mask the sarcasm.
And who will build and run the cosmic pump stations?
Lunar workers, we hope, said Gottstein.
Lunar workers, you know, said Neville. Earth workers would be too clumsy to work effectively on the moon.
We recognize that, said Gottstein. We trust the men of the moon will cooperate.
And who will decide how much energy to generate, how much to apply for any local purpose, how much to radiate away? Who decides policy?
Gottstein said, the government would have to. It is a matter of planetary decision.
Neville said,
you see, then, it will be moon men who do the work, earth men who run the show.
Gottstein said calmly,
no, all of us work who work best. All of us administer who can best weigh the total problem. I hear the words, said Neville. But it boils down anyway to us working and you deciding. No, Commissioner. The answer is no.
Do you mean you won't build the cosmic pump stations?
We'll build them, Commissioner, but they'll be ours. We'll decide how much energy to put out and what use to make of it.
That would scarcely be efficient. You would have to deal constantly with the Earth government, since the cosmic pump energy will have to balance the electron pump energy.
I dare say it will, more or less, but we have other things in mind. You might as well know now. Energy is not the only conserved phenomenon that becomes limitless once universes are crossed.
Denison interrupted.
There are a number of conservation laws. You realize that. I'm glad you do, said Neville, turning a hostile glare in his direction. They include those of linear momentum and angular momentum. As long as any object responds to the gravitational field in which it is immersed, and to that only, it is in free fall, and can retain its mass. In order to move in any other way than free fall, it must accelerate in a non-gravitational way, and for that to happen, part of itself must undergo an opposite change.
As in a rocket ship, said Denison, which must eject mass in one direction in order that the rest might accelerate in the opposite direction.
I'm sure you understand, Dr. Denison, said Neville, but I explain for the Commissioner's sake. The loss of mass can be minimized if its velocity is increased enormously, since momentum is equal to mass multiplied by velocity. Nevertheless, however great the velocity, some mass must be thrown away. If the mass which must be accelerated is enormous in the first place, then the mass which must be discarded is also enormous. If the moon, for instance...
The moon, said Gottstein explosively.
Yes, the moon, said Neville calmly. If the moon were to be driven out of its orbit and sent out of the solar system, the conservation of momentum would make it a colossal undertaking, and probably a thoroughly impractical one. If, however, momentum could be transferred to the cosmeg in another universe, the moon could accelerate at any convenient rate without loss of mass at all. It would be like pulling a barge upstream, to give you a picture I obtained from some Earth book I once read.
But why? I mean, why should you want to move the moon?
I should think that would be obvious. Why do we need the suffocating presence of the Earth? We have the energy we need. We have a comfortable world, through which we have room to expand for the next few centuries at least. Why not go our own way? In any case, we will. I have come to tell you that you cannot stop us, and to urge you to make no attempt to interfere. We shall transfer momentum, and we shall pull out. We of the moon know precisely how to go about building cosmic pump stations. We will use what energy we need for ourselves, and produce excess in order to neutralize the changes your own power stations are producing.
Denison said sardonically,
It sounds kind of you to produce excess for our sake, but it isn't for our sake, of course. If our electron pumps explode the sun, that will happen long before you can move out of even the inner solar system, and you will vaporize wherever you are.
Perhaps, said Neville, but in any case, we will produce an excess, so that won't happen.
But you can't do that, said Gottstein excitedly. You can't move out. If you get out too far, the cosmic pump will no longer neutralize the electron pump. Huh, Denison?
Denison shrugged. Once they're as far off as Saturn, more or less, there may be trouble, if I may trust the mental calculation I have just made. It will, however, be many years before they recede to such a distance. And by that time, we will surely have constructed space stations in what was once the orbit of the moon, and placed cosmic pumps on them. Actually, we don't need the moon. It can leave, except that it won't.
Neville smiled briefly. What makes you think we won't? We can't be stopped. There is no way Earthmen can impose their will on us.
You won't leave, because there's no sense to doing so.
Why drag the entire moon away? To build up respectable accelerations will take years where the moon mass is concerned, You'll creep. Build starships instead. Miles-long ships that are cosmeg-powered and have independent ecologies. With a cosmeg momentum drive, you can then do wonders. If it takes 20 years to build the ships, they will nevertheless accelerate at a rate that will enable them to overtake the moon's place within a year, even if the moon starts accelerating today. The ships will be able to change course in a tiny fraction of the time the moon will.
And the unbalanced cosmeg pumps? What will that do to the universe?
The energy required by a ship, or even by a number, will be far less than that required by a planet, and will be distributed throughout large sections of the universe. It will be millions of years before any significant change takes place. That is well worth the maneuverability you gain. The moon will move so slowly it might as well be left in space.
Neville said scornfully,
"We're in no hurry to get anywhere, except away from Earth."
Dennison said, "There are advantages in having the Earth as a neighbor. You have the influx of the immigrants. You have cultural intercourse. You have a planetary world of 2 billion people just over the horizon. Do you want to give all that up?"
"Gladly."
"Is that true of the people of the moon generally, or just of you? There's something intense about you, Neville. You won't go out on the surface. Other lunarites do. They don't like it particularly, but they do. The interior of the moon isn't their womb, as it is in your case. It isn't their prison, as it is in yours. There is a neurotic factor in you that is absent in most lunarites, or at least considerably weaker. If you take the moon away from Earth, you make it into a prison for all. It will become a one-world prison from which no man, and not you only, can emerge, not even to the extent of seeing another inhabited world in the sky. Perhaps that is what you want."
"I want independence, a free world, a world untouched by the outside."
"You can build ships, any number. You can move outward at near-light velocities without difficulty once you transfer momentum to the cosmeg. You can explore the entire universe in a single lifetime. Wouldn't you like to get on such a ship?"
"No," said Neville, with clear distaste.
"Wouldn't you? Or is it couldn't? Is it that you must take the moon with you wherever you go? Why must all the others accept your need?"
"Because that's the way it's going to be," said Neville.
Dennison's voice remained level, but his cheeks reddened. "Who gave you the right to say that? There are many citizens of Luna City who may not feel as you do."
"That is none of your concern."
"That is precisely my concern. I am an immigrant who will qualify for citizenship soon. I do not wish to have my choice made for me by someone who cannot emerge on the surface and who wants his personal prison made into a prison for all. I have left Earth forever, but only to come to the moon, only to remain 250,000 miles away from the home planet. I have not contracted to be taken forever away for an unlimited distance."
"Then return to Earth," said Neville indifferently. "There is still time."
"And what of the other citizens of Luna, the other immigrants?"
"The decision is made."
"It is not made."
"Selene."
Selene entered, her face solemn, her eyes a little defiant. Neville's legs uncrossed. Both shoes came down flat upon the ground. Neville said,
"How long have you been waiting in the next room, Selene?"
"Since before you arrived, Baron," she said. Neville looked from Selene to Dennison and back again.
"You two,"
he began, finger pointing from one to the other and back. "I don't know what you mean by you two," said Selene, "but Ben found out about the momentum quite a while ago."
"It wasn't Selene's fault," said Dennison. "The commissioner spotted something flying at a time when no one could possibly have known he would be observing. It seemed to me that Selene might be testing something I was not thinking of, and transfer of momentum eventually occurred to me. After that..."
"Well, then, you knew," said Neville. "It doesn't matter."
"It does, Baron," said Selene. "I talked about it with Ben.
I found that I didn't always have to accept what you said. Perhaps I can't ever go to Earth. Perhaps I don't even want to. But I found I liked it in the sky where I could see it if I wanted to. I didn't want an empty sky. Then I talked to others of the group. Not everybody wants to leave. Most people would rather build the ships and let those go who wish to go, while allowing those to remain behind who wish to remain. Neville's breath was coming hard.
You talked about it! Who gave you the right to...
I took the right, Baron. Besides, it doesn't matter anymore. You'll be outvoted.
Because of...
Neville rose to his feet and took a menacing step toward Denison. The commissioner said, Please don't get emotional, Dr. Neville. You may be of Luna, but I don't think you can manhandle both of us.
All three, said Felony,
and I'm of Luna, too. I did it, Baron, not they. Then Denison said, Look, Neville, for all Earth cares, the moon can go. Earth can build its space stations. It's the citizens of Luna City who care. Selene cares, and I care, and the rest. You are not being debarred from space, from escape, from freedom. In 20 years at the outside, all who want to go will go, including you, if you can bring yourself to leave the room. And those who want to stay will stay. Slowly, Neville seated himself again. There was the look of defeat on his face. 19. In Selene's apartment, every window now had a view of the Earth. She said, The vote did go against him, you know, Ben, quite heavily. I doubt that he'll give up, though. If there's friction with Earth during the building of the stations, public opinion on the moon may swing back. There needn't be friction.
No, there needn't. In any case, there are no happy endings in history. Only crisis points that pass.
We've passed this one safely, I think, and we'll worry about the others as they come and as they can be foreseen. Once the starships are built, the tension will surely subside considerably.
We'll live to see that, I'm sure.
You will, Selene.
You too, Ben. Don't overdramatize your age. You're only 48.
Would you go on one of the starships, Selene?
No. I'd be too old, and I still wouldn't want to lose Earth in the sky. My son might go.
Ben?
Yes, Selene?
I have applied for a second son. The application has been accepted. Would you contribute?
Denison's eyes lifted and looked straight into hers. She did not look away.
He said, Artificial insemination?
She said, Of course. The gene combination should be interesting.
Denison's eyes dropped.
I would be flattered, Selene.
Selene said defensively, That's just good sense, Ben. It's important to have good gene combinations. There's nothing wrong with some natural genetic engineering.
None at all.
It doesn't mean that I don't want it for other reasons, too. Because I like you.
Denison nodded and remained silent.
Selene said, almost angrily, Well, there's more to love than sex.
Denison said, I agree to that. At least, I love you even with sex subtracted.
And Selene said, And, for that matter, there is more to sex than acrobatics.
Denison said, I agree to that, too.
And Selene said, And besides, Oh, damn it, you could try to learn.
Denison said softly, If you would try to teach.
Hesitantly, he moved toward her. She did not move away.
He stopped hesitating.
End of The Gods Themselves by Isaac Asimov. Narrated by Patricia Redding LeClaire in the studios of the Division for the Blind and Physically Handicapped for the Library of Congress. November 1977. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522 with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Doubleday and Company, Incorporated. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, Please tie a bit of string around one of the container straps before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container, braille side down, for identification.